Listen Up, der Podcast der Uni Potsdam.
Agribusiness and ending hunger don't always walk hand in hand. A case study from Brazil with Henrique Casagrande Barbosa.
More than 400 people waiting in line. Some on their own, some with their family, children, elderly, even pets. Some of which had arrived the previous afternoon and slept there through the night, waiting in the line that disappeared down the street, extending for multiple blocks. The event? A local slaughterhouse was donating the so-called ossinho, a term that roughly translates to little bone. Scraps of carcass with little pieces of meat attached to them here and there. A leftover so sparse that couldn't even be sold. At the door, those that made it to the end of the line received a half-full white plastic bag and cheered. It wasn't much, but it was just enough to make broth with. And right before Christmas in 2021, with the pandemic still lurking around, things were especially tight. Many had lost their jobs, but even those with a regular occupation had a difficult time putting enough food on the table. As for the location, Cuiabá, capital of the state of Mato Grosso, Brazil's biggest agricultural producer. Funnily enough, within the agribusiness, the word pandemic and its consequences had a surprisingly different tone. The now disrupted supply chains of the international market meant more demand for Brazilian exports such as soy and beef, and a devalued currency made it much more attractive to sell the goods abroad rather than internally, causing skyrocketing prices to all household staples. Paradoxically, at the same time that people stood in line for food scrap donations, new records of revenue and production levels were being set for the agriculture sector of the economy. Alas, the country's complicated dynamics of food production and consumption were exposed, perhaps now more bare than ever. Welcome, dear listener. My name is Henrique Barbosa, and I'm a Brazilian student currently pursuing a politics and economics bachelor at the University of Potsdam. This podcast is the end result of a collaboration between the UP and the Pontifical Bolivarian University Bucaramanga in Colombia. In this lecture series, the objective was to collectively explore the United Nations SDGs, that is, the Sustainable Development Goals. Those were adopted in 2015 as part of the organization's 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, an ambitious plan to eradicate poverty and protect the planet whilst ensuring just and proper conditions for all of humanity. The subject is honestly very personal to me due to the connection between Germany, where I live nowadays, and Latin America, where I come from. And the idea of a partnership towards a common goal, where one region could learn from the other, was particularly compelling. This episode will also include sections of an interview I conducted earlier this year with Isabel Teixeira Pires. Ms. Pires is a Brazilian political science student at Freie Universität Berlin and staff member of Scripts, Arbeitsstelle Europäische Integration at the Otto Suhr Institut, where she is currently on leave due to her participation in the Visiting International Student Program at Johns Hopkins University. She recently wrote a literature review titled Achieving Zero Hunger, a case study of the landless workers' movement and the achievement of the SDG 2 in Brazil. The paper provides powerful insight for policymaking and is a prime example of how the knowledge generated in political science can help guide countries' decisions towards achieving the SDGs. But now back to where we left things. It was the striking contradiction between hunger and food abundance in Brazil that first pulled me into the topic. I started by researching the developments we had made on several SDGs. Out of the 17 goals encompassing themes from education to climate action and from strong institutions to gender equality, the second number on the list drew my attention.
SDG number 2, to end hunger, achieve food security and improved nutrition, and promote sustainable agriculture.
The reason for this sudden interest of mine is the fact that Brazil became well-known and to some extent an international example for its progress on the issue of malnutrition from the mid-2000s to mid-2010s. And I lived to see that change happen. The at-the-time government of the Workers' Party, led by Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, considered the country's high undernourishment rate as a top priority problem, giving birth to their zero hunger strategy. The plan recognized the complexity of the issue and focused on not only creating but also linking state programs together in an attempt to tackle all of its many faces in a connected way. It consisted of four main aspects: facilitating access to food, supporting agriculture with focus on local family farming, income generation, and social mobilization. The first of them, access to food, which includes both physical but most importantly economical access, was at the heart of the question. The country was and still is marked by strong inequality, and food availability meant nothing if it couldn't be purchased by the lower classes. There are two measures I want to highlight in this category for their effects, but also for showcasing the plan's interconnecting approach. Firstly, there is Bolsa Família. It was rolled out in 2003 and is basically a cash transfer program where low-income families would enroll to receive monthly financial assistance. While it provided immediate relief and guaranteed that such families could buy the necessary food, it also came with conditions that aimed to create long-term development, linking it to income generation. What conditions? Well, amongst them was the requirement that the children of participants attended school regularly, so that in the future, they were also able to ascend economically. Secondly, there was the National School Feeding Program, PNAE, which provided free meals to students in the public school system. Again, at the same time that it generated immediate food access, the measure doubled up as an agriculture support system, as 30% of the food offered in the program had to come from local family farms. As for the other categories, the intended goal was much more of a structural change, facilitating access to credit and insurance to family farmers, as well as securing state purchases of their production to be used in other programs, provided an extra level of safety to the occupation of those impacted. Combined with stimulus to income generation, such as vocational training, for example, individuals that were before stuck in poverty were now enabled to not only avoid hunger themselves, but to contribute to the larger scheme of warming up the economy. Even though one needs to be cautious and admit its shortcomings, it is in no way partisan to say that the plan worked. In fact, it made food security peak in 2013, and on the following year, the country was removed from the FAO's World Hunger Map, FAO being the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. Their data pointed to an 82% decrease in malnutrition between 2002 and 2014. And at the end of that period, only about 1.7% of Brazilians were undernourished, as opposed to a figure close to 10% in the beginning. To put things in perspective, the organization's threshold for including a country in the hunger map is 2.5%. But this progress was unfortunately short-lived. The following years proved a turbulent time for the nation's politics, featuring an impeachment succeeded by a drastic change in policy. Soon after, in 2018, right-wing politician Jair Messias Bolsonaro was elected as president and the country experienced the pandemic under his internationally criticized administration.
Between 2020 and 2022, the number of people suffering from hunger in the country doubled to 33 million. And last year, Brazil returned to FAO's World Hunger Map.
But how did this happen? How did so much get undone in such a short time? Well, it certainly depends on who you ask, as there are a lot of factors involved, allowing for many different explanations. For today's guest, Isabel Pierce, The culmination of a global economic crisis, the COVID-19 pandemic, and high unemployment should all be, amongst other reasons, considered. But in her recent paper, Achieving Zero Hunger, she places a lot of focus on the austerity impositions by the government of Bolsonaro and his predecessor, Michel Temer. The key takeaway here is that many, if not most, of the programs I've just discussed, that were all part of the Workers' Party Zero Hunger plan, were dismantled, defunded, or outright cancelled.
So regarding public policies, these are probably most relevant. So the first one is the austerity cap that was introduced as a constitutional amendment in 2016, and it basically limits public spending for 20 years. And there have been direct impacts. So for example, by the next year in 2017, federal funding for food security programs had already been reduced by 55%. And we see that very clearly in the case of the food acquisition program and the school feeding program, which were very important in incentivizing smallholder and family farming production. It was a way that the government would buy that production from these small farmers and redistribute it. So, for example, among prisonal systems, universities, hospitals, all sorts of public institutions would receive the food from this program. And then the school feeding program is just the specific one for public schools. So it was an incentive for small farmers and more sustainable production. And it still exists, but it's been largely defunded. And then also in 2019, the Federal Ministry for Social Development was established, as well as the National Council of Food and Nutritional Security, which is quite problematic because these were the institutions responsible for monitoring the development of food security in Brazil, coordinating the efforts among federal, state, and municipal levels. And especially we call it Conselho, the council, was responsible for involving civil society actors. So they would have regular conferences and NGOs and other actors, like local community leaders, were invited to propose different policies or to talk about the current situation, and that institutional space no longer exists.
All of these reforms accumulated over time and can be easily summarized in this tweet by Brazilian journalist Florestan Fernandes Jr., made in June of last year. 589 million reais. That was the budget in 2012 to guarantee access to food and encourage family farming. In 2019, the budget lost 93%, going down to 41 million. Today, it's barely nothing, 89,000. For each of the 33 million hungry people, Jair Bolsonaro set aside 0.2 cents per year. As I researched, I was presented with this worsening situation in Brazil, and some questions started popping in my head. Of course, the government should invest in an area as important as food security, but why was such a big effort needed to make sure every citizen got enough food in a country placed as the fourth biggest agricultural producer in the world? Surely, out of any place, we should have an easier time dealing with this problem, right? Of course, reality was much more nuanced than that. But as childish as that line of thinking could have felt at the time, there was a thread to be followed. What was standing there, blocking the way between the produced food and the table of so many Brazilians? And since it was so easy to reverse the progress made in combating hunger, how can we fundamentally change things to make sure that doesn't happen again? To help answer those questions, I'd like to first define a term already used in this discussion: agribusiness. First of all, agribusiness is not synonymous with agriculture. Agriculture serves as an umbrella term to a wide range of activities related to the cultivation of crops and rearing of animals, be it for human consumption or industry use, and most importantly, be it for subsistence or commercial purposes. Agribusiness, however, is a much more difficult term to define because of its ever-changing usage both in and outside of academia, and also because of big disagreements between authors on the word's meaning. it is also definitely not just any business related to agriculture, like selling a small produce at a farmer's market, as that definition would include its counterpart, family farming. What does the word mean then? Well, it depends on the context. But in the political discussion, and especially in Brazil's case, agribusiness, or in Portuguese, agronegócio, is generally used to describe large-scale operations that usually take place in vast pieces of lands with hundreds to thousands or even tens of thousands of employees. But further than just farming on a large scale, there are two key features of the system that are absolutely relevant for our discussion. The first is the intensive use of the land. Such businesses operate with focus on high productivity and make use of technologies such as artificial fertilizers, irrigation, soil drainage, and perhaps amongst the most controversial, pesticides. As a little side tangent, former President Bolsonaro became internationally infamous for the new approval of 562 chemical pesticides in the single year of 2021. Amongst those were substances that are banned in the European Union. But the second and most relevant feature of our discussion is agribusiness's relation to the commodity market. I would personally even go as far as to say that that is what truly differentiates it from family farming. It is a system that produces commodities, that is, homogeneous goods with a defined price in the international market, and that most of the time serve as raw materials for the production of other goods. Notable examples for that are grains such as soy for making cattle feed or corn for producing alcohol. Its focus on the international market is so big that according to the Brazilian Institute for Geography and Statistics, 70% of the food consumed in the country is produced exclusively by small-scale family farming. As agribusiness mainly exports, just a small fraction of what it produces actually makes it to the internal market. This number becomes surprising when considering that a recent Oxfam report revealed that almost half of the entire rural area of the country is concentrated on less than 1% of rural properties. This contrast between land concentration and hunger is at the essence of Pierce's paper.
In the first place, I want to frame hunger as a political problem. Often it's considered as a natural problem just because of droughts or heavy rains or things like that. But in the context of Brazil, I think it's very valuable to point out the political aspect of this. For example, the extreme land concentration and centuries of destructive plantation cycles, which are some of the colonial heritages that Brazil has.
It became more than clear to me at that point that hunger was not only a matter of food quantity, but of perspective, and two opposing perspectives competed for how policy was made on the issue.
The discussion that's very relevant in peasant studies about food security versus food sovereignty. So food security is the term, the definition that is mostly used by policymakers in international organizations, including the UN, and it's mostly about access to food. So it's about people having the ability to have enough food, enough nutrition, but it doesn't really question where the food is coming from or who produces the food, what the quality of the food is, and so on. So it kind of allows for the status quo to remain with the dominance of transnational corporations, use of pesticides, large-scale farming, and so on. So the concept of food sovereignty is critical of the concept of food security, and it was coined by social movements, specifically in Latin America, and one of them is the Landless Workers Movement that we call MST. And it shows us that it's important to pay attention to power relations in the food system. So, you know, who decides what is planted, where, how it is planted, for whom it is planted and produced. And it calls for more democratic participation so that the producers themselves, small family farmers, have also more decision rights. And they also claim that we need more to pay more attention to environmental protection and also think about more radical shifts, including land reforms.
this distinction between food security and food sovereignty is probably the key takeaway from her work for policymaking. A simple shift in perspective, but that applied to a nation's policies, proved monumental in their consequences. The governments that came after 2014 and that enacted the reforms that eventually dissolved the measures put in place by the Zero Hunger Plan were very clearly more in line with the concept of food security and dismissed its counterpart. Policies stimulating the agribusiness were taken as top priority, arguably because of the revenue and the big percentage of the GDP that that sector represents, as much as 27% in 2021. Meanwhile, family farming was defunded and neglected, as seen in the budget cuts we previously talked about. And although the plan attempted some level of structural change, that is, to boost more sustainable modes of production, such as small-scale, extensive farming, and include this perspective of social movements on food systems, it ultimately failed in making those the norm. Too many root causes remained unaddressed, such as the country's land inequality. This, in turn, allowed for a simple change in government orientation to make malnutrition return to the, so to say, initial conditions that we see today, as the country faces the biggest hunger crisis since the 90s. To get back on track in combating hunger and achieve SDG number 2, Brazil would then need to refocus on creating a solid sovereign base in terms of food systems. But this approach might clash with the UN's recommendations. Pierce recognizes a certain dissonance between the intended goal and the proposed measures, especially when applied to the country's case.
These are the main UN proposals regarding this goal. So it's about enhancing agricultural productivity, preventing market distortions, and ensuring the proper functioning of food commodity markets. These are all very valid options, but in the case of Brazil, it was a bit contradicting, I would say, because especially regarding productivity, Brazil is already extremely productive in the agricultural sector. So I was a bit skeptical whether increasing productivity would solve hunger or if it would just maintain the status quo. And then also correcting and preventing trade restrictions is also, of course, valid. In Brazil, there is, however, a situation where big agricultural producers tend to prefer to export because it's more lucrative. So allowing for free trade to function properly is valid, but it doesn't necessarily solve hunger because there would have to be some sort of focus on the internal markets to avoid so much focus on exports.
All in all, this is a contradiction to be solved by the nation between now and 2030, by the time the goals of the Sustainable Development Agenda are to be fulfilled. But at the same time, it's a pressing matter. It's people's lives that are on the line and the clock is ticking. It's more than 400 people standing in line for food donations, but an entirety of 33 million hungry Brazilians whose nutritional needs are being neglected. If I allow myself to be frank now and share my personal opinion, it will definitely take radical actions in terms of policy to reverse the damage and shift to a state of food sovereignty. Those would include the following: reopening public spaces for discussion of the food production system, which in turn would allow for democratic participation of civil society. Land reforms and similar measures that touch on the deep roots of land inequality in the country and that determine how our economy and politics function. Immediate relief to those in a critical hunger situation, but also followed up by programs to guarantee that they don't return to it. And the list goes on. It will also take stepping out of the UN guidelines. But on the flip side, this can serve as a lesson and motivation for other countries that find themselves in such conflicting positions. In fact, the contrast between the proposed measures and Brazil's situation only goes to show the hardships of generating meaningful definitions while still being broad enough to encompass the unique details of every member state. But it is only through questioning and opening this kind of debate that knowledge towards development can be exchanged. This kind of paper, such as Pierce's, is one of the many pieces of a collective puzzle to be solved, and it highlights the importance of all sciences in the achievement of the SDGs. After all, it's a global agenda we're talking about.
Listen Up, der Podcast der Uni Potsdam.
Produziert von SpeakLow im Auftrag der Innovativen Hochschule Potsdam.